I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Peter Cohen is a fashion industry enigma. He's an independent designer who's been successfully creating beautiful clothes from his atelier in Los Angeles for over 30 years. I love learning about his childhood in Zimbabwe and how his life unfolded halfway across the world. Well, I'm sorry I'm not in LA with you. I would have loved to have done this in person because, one, I think that your studio is so charming.
Oh, thank you.
And you've been there for how many years, Peter?
Oh, gosh, 30 plus.
Wow.
Like, really, like, yeah, 30, yeah. 35, most probably.
Well, that's amazing.
It is amazing. It truly is.
And it's so inspiring to go because when you come into the showroom, you walk through the workroom and you see all these people that have worked for you for hundreds of years.
No, truly. 30s
of years.
Yes, no, I mean, we've got, we have quite a few second generations, actually. I don't think we have third yet, but we have two. Pretty amazing. It's amazing.
I really didn't remember that you were from Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Tell me what that's like. Tell me about growing up in Zimbabwe.
Well, you know, I think your childhood is normal wherever you are. So there's no point of reference. So it was in retrospect, I mean, I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Africa. And it was a pretty normal childhood. But I left Zimbabwe when I was about 14 and moved to South Africa.
Wait, how old were you when you moved to South Africa?
14. And I left when I was 18. So I was only there for 4 years. But the one kind of, because I were the impressionable years, it kind of erased a bit of the memory of Zimbabwe.
And did your parents, did they stay when you left at 18?
No, my parents actually moved both times because I had an older brother who was 2 years older than me. And there was national conscription in Zimbabwe at the time. And they moved to South Africa because of the war that was going on, which wasn't a winnable war. And then the same thing happened 4 years later in South Africa. So my folks really moved for our sake. I don't think the decision, if it hadn't been, they might have stuck around there. But it was a good decision for them to move, though.
Were your parents born in Zimbabwe?
Both actually in South Africa.
South Africa?
Yeah, they were South Africans and then they moved to Zimbabwe.
What did they do in Zimbabwe? They were farmers?
Farmed, yeah. My dad farmed maize, corn.
Oh, wow. Can you paint like the landscape for me, what it was like to grow up in Zimbabwe? What it looked like?
You could hear the grass grow after rain. I mean, the nature is like so much more alive and vital there. And it's very, Zimbabwe particularly, but really after a hard rain, you can actually see and sense, you can sense the grass is growing. It's, the energy of the nature is a lot. It's Africa.
Yeah. And what was your childhood like? You lived on the farm.
Spoiled childhood. Spoiled by my mother,
And just you two boys? It was just the two of you?
Just the two of us, yeah.
Yeah, and just running around and
And things that in retrospect seem like you can't believe that's really what happened. My brother went to school by horse and cart. The neighbor would pick them up. And by the time I was going to that school that we left to the bigger city, like you don't recognize these things often as being extraordinary at the time.
Yeah.
You just take them, you take a bit of it for granted.
You weren't near a city in Zimbabwe. And then when you moved to South Africa, where did you move?
Cape Town.
And what was that like?
Yeah, I was there 14 to 18. So they were, those adolescent years. So they weren't the best years, but they're the ones that made a big impression. You remember the negative things, as they say, much better than you do the positives. So as a kid, again, I was there and it wasn't, particularly pleasant, high school years, et cetera. I mean, I have no bones with it, though. I mean, I've got no bones with it. Impressions count. I met a guy who was like the class jock, captain of the cricket team. He was a surfer. He rode a motorbike. I bumped into him years later. And he said to me, "Peter Cohen, God, I remember you. You didn't care about anything." And I was like, "Oh my God." I was like, I just love that you're telling me this. You couldn't be more inaccurate, but that I gave that impression. I mean, Jesus, thank you.
That's hilarious. Hilarious. Did you have a first sort of fashion memory or style memory from Zimbabwe or from Cape Town?
We all used to go on kibbutz volunteer as after high school, after 16. And they somehow had these plaid shirts in Israel that were these like kind of colorful, like plaids in unusual bright combinations, like orange and blue. And I think my brother came back and it was like the most coveted thing if you could get your hands on one of these plaid shirts.
And not like a Maasai plaid, but like a, like what kind of colors, like a red and.
Yeah, a little Maasai-like.
It was a little
Maasai. Yes, Maasai. Yeah, it really was. I mean, they were kind of that kind of like high contrast and, you know, unusual. I don't know why they were weaving them. I don't know the history of them, but, and we used to, you know, pilfer them from the kibbutz. So whenever, when my, you know, we all went after we were 16 and I think they were part of their dress, part of their uniform there, but it was a big thing to get your hands on one. So that's
that's so interesting. Did you recognize, I guess, when you got to Cape Town, was there a way that women had adorned themselves in Zimbabwe that was unusual or different that you remembered?
Well, Cape Town had made a very big impression on me stylistically, I think, because people look really good with very little. So there's not a lot of tricks. There's not a lot of fashion. What was available wasn't a lot, but people looked amazing. You know, they looked really, they had a way of putting themselves together with very little that had very good, to good effect, shall we just say. And that sort of remained, you know, that's all, you know, that's always been a
pillar for you.
Yes.
I think it definitely is. I mean, yeah. I think when you think about your clothes, it's so minimal. So little does so much.
People are very attractive creatures. There's a lot going on to start with. You've got the face, you've got the hair, you've got the limbs, you've got a lot going on. On some level, I do like to get out of the way of that because I've got a very hungry eye. So things, I get distracted very easily. And so if there's a lot too much going on, I'm, you know, you want clothes to flatter you and get you ready to just go out there. I mean, that's their purpose, you know, and at some point you got to go out whether you, you know, it's that's
you're as ready whether you're ready
as,
or not,
whether you're ready or not, or you're as ready as you will be. And so you better get out there. I mean, clothes play that role in my life. Like I don't want to, you know, I'm not enthusiastic about going anywhere until I've found something I'm happy in wearing.
It's so, oh my God, I feel the same way. That is so true.
So true.
Every one of my clients the same way. I mean, that's the whole, you know, I go in my closet and there's nothing to wear. It's filled up with nothing to wear. So the trick is to find the thing that makes you want to go out.
Absolutely.
So Peter, when you were on your way out of Cape Town, did you or your parents have any expectations about what your career would be or what it would be like?
Not really. You know, we moved like young enough to not really have the immediate pressure of having to do anything. So we had a bit of wiggle room, where we did nothing. I did phone sales when I first got here for a company called Dial America from 5 to 9 p.m. We used to sell like the local paper and the TV guide when there was a thing. And it was for Big Brothers. And it was my favorite job in the world because it was from 5 o'clock to 9 o'clock. I had my whole day free. I had my whole night free. It was the only hours I was happy to sacrifice. And I was, you know, good at it because, you know, whatever. I can, you know, the accent helped.
You moved from Cape Town to LA and your whole family, everybody?
The whole family, yes. Over a bit of period of time. My brother had moved to Paris before and had come back, yeah. I also got a job doing men's sports shirts. I designed sports shirts for men and at a company downtown. And then I moved to New York and my life, you know, it was at 23. I remember angering my dad very much. So once driving out to Palm Springs with a friend of his, and I was like, when I was about 22, and the guy asked me, what do you do? And I said, nothing. And my dad was so like, he would anger, not irregularly, but he was so pissed off. Like, how can you say that about yourself? And I do see 23 as a bit of a pivotal year
Yeah.
for everybody. I see it generally and as a pattern. Like, I didn't really have much of a course, but at 23, you have to jump on some wagon at that age. And
Yeah.
fortunately, I did.
How did it come to be fashion? I mean, were you a fashionable person? I mean, you're really handsome.
Oh, thank you. Exactly. Will you still love me when I'm 64? I turn 64 next year. This year, I
Yes,
turn. I turn this year.
I still love you. I definitely still love you.
Okay. Thank you.
Had
Wow, that helps.
people admired your style? I mean, how did that come about?
I didn't grow up with friends who were fashion people. I mean, my friends were like, well, that wasn't something, of
Right.
interest. So I kind of dressed like everybody else, except I was very deliberate about, I had this khakis, but mine were a little different. And if to the eye that cared, you could notice mine was a little different. To somebody who didn't care, you weren't
It was
bothering
just
them.
khakis. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's a little bit of a secret pleasure, basically, like, as to what you're saying about it's how you feel about what you're wearing. It may not read in the way you're imagining it, but it's affecting the way you feel about
Yeah,
it.
it's so true.
The big change in my life was when I worked in New York for a designer named Peter Kea, Kea, and he was from Ohio, and it was like 1982, and he was the man of the moment at the time. He was he'd worked for Giorgio Sant'Angelo, and he sold to all the best stores, and he was a big influence. He was a huge influence in terms of like how to go about it. That you could, he had a 360 square foot studio in on the corner of Houston and Broadway, and we would go there and sew his clothes, and he was in the papers and selling to, Tucker Shima. He was selling to all
Oh,
the
wow.
Japanese stores, the big, Charivari. He was in the best stores. He
Cool.
was
Yeah.
really, he was the guy of the moment, and he was a extraordinary designer. And I actually, it took years a little bit to shake his influence.
What was the most important thing that you learned from him?
It really, I think, just his aesthetics, were very minimal, were very reduced, and artistic. He had extraordinary style. He'd wear the same thing 24 hours, all day, but he'd change his shoes at night. He'd have sneakers on the day, and at night he had these extraordinary, like, patent leather, brogues. They're just the tips. I don't know what the style is,
Oh my God, I love it.
and it was and he was it was evening wear, and that was it.
And did he encourage your own creativity or encourage you to go out on your own?
His production guy was Stuart Cox, who is my partner today, and he got me the job there, and they were friends, and I only worked there for 6 months, and Stuart was running his operation, and Stuart has become like central to my business as my
Yeah.
business partner, and I think he showed me, like, at that point, the options would be to get some corporate job, in my head, like
Right,
I'd get a
right.
job doing this and I'd doing that. And he showed me that you could do something on your own, and you could just take it out there, and that was the sort of avenue to go down, that you could actually do it in a less orthodox way.
Did you have a feeling that there was something out there that you hadn't seen before, that feeling that there was a hole in the market that you could fill?
My first collection was an androgynous collection. I did like men's and women's, and I sold it to both men and women. I had a lot invested on in arguing this issue, and I also thought clothes communicated more than I do now in some way, because I really thought they could ch change things, and I was 23, so I was, it was the age of miracles, as they say. So I really I believed all kinds of stuff, and so that was my that was like a big driving force. In when I started, like I really did, I argue this point that there it's always been about the points of intersection in a way. And when I started, it was the points of male female intersection, where they become where a beautiful man and a beautiful woman look the same, basically. Like there's a point where they, you know, that a beautiful they intersect. And and as I say, those were real sort of, you know,
well, radical ideas at the time.
Radical ideas at the time, and like strong enough ones to, you know, to motivate you, you know, to have some sort of, you know, axe to grind or whatever the better term for it is, you know. But it was a bit of a mission on my part.
Huh. And so you and Stuart moved to LA.
To LA, yep.
Did you start making clothes right away?
Started making clothes right away, and
wow.
And then I just took them, you know, I took them to San Francisco, and I sold to Wilkes Bashford.
Wow.
And then I sold to Barney's, and then I took them to New York, and it was, you know, when you're starting off, there are ways, always ways to get things done, but there was a time you could call up.
Yeah.
You know, the paper and say, you know, blah, blah, right. blah, blah, blah. Can I come down there with my suitcase? And they said, sure.
And what was it like working in LA as opposed to New York? Was it a different way of working?
Very much so. Way more impressionable. You know, New York, you kind of have to make it in the first few seasons or it's next, you know. And LA has a broader range of broader tolerance of opinions than New York does. You know, New York has a consensus about what is taste and what is good and what is the correct at that, you know, and it's quite strongly held. LA is very different on that level. You know, there's a level of costume to LA that appeals to me.
Did you know Wilkes Bashford and, I mean, obviously Barney's, but did you know those places, Susan or,
yes,
you know, did you know those because of Peter Key or did you know that just from being
a you
person?
Know, I just knew of them. Yeah. I have no connection with that. I don't remember.
And you and Stuart instinctively knew, like, this is the type of store I want my clothes to be in. This is the level, and this would be the price point, and all of that. You already knew that. This is the person I want to serve.
Yes and no, because I also started off resisting selling anything over $100. Like that was out of comprehension. I was like, no. And we pushed it up to 125, and we did well with them at 125. So to that point is like, did I go after that audience? I'm not sure. You know, I just thought, you know, the clothes would be recognized. I mean, it's funny with clothes. You don't really get to choose your audience. They choose you.
They choose you. So I guess that would be my next question is, did you start out with this sort of trunk show model from the beginning? I think you did, right? I mean, you met your clients from the beginning.
I did. That's true. That is true. I did.
Because I think that's really unusual. And that,
yes.
I mean, that really probably turned, because you had women from the start saying,
yes,
I really need this.
And to this day, I mean, I love to see women in my clothes. So I'm like, you know, if they... I really enjoy it. I enjoy seeing them. You know, I think they look better in my clothes. So I'm happy to see the change that goes on when they do wear them, to the point where I don't recognize them. You know, I mean, I see people and I'm like, oh, God, you look nice. And she's like, that's your clothes. I'm like, oh, my God, go on.
Well, the other thing about your clothes is that you never get rid of them. I don't know if I've told you this. I have a dress from 20 years ago.
Amazing.
And my daughter, it's, you know, it's bias cut, so it's short on me now.
Yeah.
But it looks amazing on my daughter.
Incredible.
I mean, it's in perfect shape.
Incredible. That's incredible. Well, I mean,
that's the goal, right?
That is the goal. I mean, the goal is to, you know, endure the whatever, you know, like my ego is more invested in keeping feeling looking the same than I am in terms of trends. And I think there's a lot of women out there who feel the same way. They have a way of seeing themselves and they want to keep seeing themselves in that same way. And and I think, you know, clothes let you do that for sure. And I mean, it's definitely what I depend on clothes for.
that first collection, did you have a show in LA?
I didn't have a show, but I had 2 pages in American Vogue.
Wow.
I had a double spread in Esquire. I had Dwayne Mickles photographed it for GQ. I mean, it was like kind of crazy. I had a, you know, it was really, the clothes really got around. They kind of made an impression, shall we say.
Where did it go from there? Because if you got all of that press from those different places and it was a unisex collection, how did you seg into luxury women?
It worked better on women than it did on men, like on a commercial level as well. And so it actually was selling more to women than men. The men's was like a smaller audience. And but then I also recognized that, you know, there are differences. And that's a good thing. And so, you know, they, and there's a full spectrum of differences, you know, and women's wear is women's clothes and men, you know, just.
Yeah.
That,
I mean, I have a men's store, so I get you.
Yeah.
It's a very different business. I mean, it's a completely different business.
Yeah,
like a total, even a different part of your brain almost. It just does, they don't relate at all.
I think a little of what we do with clothes is you imbue a bit of confidence in somebody, because that's really what clothes do, you know, and they connect you.
That first collection was covered by tons of different people.
Yes.
But was there a moment that you felt like was really your big break, or the moment where you saw that this was really going to work?
Yeah, I think that was it.
Really? Because sometimes press doesn't, that can actually crush a business sometimes, you know?
100%. I mean, the ironic thing with it is that there was no business. You know, there was a lot of press.
Yeah.
There was I was selling 5 shirts a week, you know, and or whatever, you know, like I'd sold to 3 stores and I had this, you know, national like coverage.
So was Stuart like, this is a business, let's get going?
You know, God, he has held the business together from the day one. I mean, for sure, he really has. And and I, you know, I'm just a bit of a rainmaker. So I just keep making new, you know, I just keep looking ahead and not really dealing with the present or the past much.
Did you ever have any designers mentor you, or did you ever have anybody that you could call and ask, like, I don't know what I'm doing with this, you know, linings or, whatever.
I had two, you know, I had one. A woman named Harriet Selwyn, who was a clothing designer in LA, who was a huge, I mean, was a mentor, a support on every level, you know, someone who believed in me, and, you know, whatever that special energy you give to somebody when you, you know, really stand, you know, believe in them. And we had Jill Bradell represented her and represented me together. And, I learned a lot from her, so much. One of the things that come to mind is it's a build-up, was her line. So it's like, you show them linen this season, they don't buy it, next season they will. It's a build-up. And if
she was right.
I turned that to gold, let me tell you. So that was a huge piece of valuable advice.
I love that.
And she was an extraordinary designer. It's interesting. Her clothes had life. They had energy. You know, they were glamorous.
There were 2 designers. Who was the other person that supported you?
The other one was Zoran.
Oh, wow. He comes up a lot, actually.
I got to know him after I'd started, and I was unfamiliar with what he was doing until way later. As I was developing what I was doing, I didn't know of him. And but we became friends. We had a very minimalist relationship, but he was somebody I spent time with. And he, at the time, he was also the king of New York. You know, he was doing it all on his own terms.
He's revolutionary. I mean,
absolutely.
He did something that nobody had ever done.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
They always said, like, when the Row got started, that the collection, the entire collection of the Row, was based on Zoran.
They said about that about me as well. I mean,
I mean, what a compliment.
Both ways, that mine was based on his and theirs is based on mine. So that's also been said quite a bit. So
it is true.
He captured the moment like nobody, you know, and he would ship whatever he wanted to stores. He wouldn't even let them order. Yeah, he would just say, Send them a box of this, you know, they need 20 pence, and he'd just send it. And they would take it. As Adina Laya came to New York, the only designer he wanted to meet was Zoran. And the same with Ferré. You know, he was really the New York designer at that time.
Was he self-taught also, or was he, Serbian?
Is he Serbian? Yeah. He was an architect. I think he trained as an
yes.
architect. Yeah.
Yeah. God, he was a genius.
He was really good. I mean, the interesting thing I've got to say is the weird thing is that his clothes, I mean, yes, they knocked off, but that's partly because they, you know, but they're not studied in the way like Halston.
Yeah.
You know,
they
not,
should be.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't think they survived that test.
You think it was more of a zeitgeist moment?
Yeah, a zeitgeist moment. I think so.
What advice did he give you? Did he give you any great actual advice?
He was opening a store. He was out here in LA opening a store and spent a number of months out here. He said to me that, you know, to survive, to thrive in the luxury market, I would need to use high-end fabrics, luxury fabrics, like that. That the two just go hand in hand. That the luxury market and luxury fabrics are synonymous, basically. And it was probably was something I was resisting at the time because I was much more interested in, you know, just approximating,
wanting to keep the price point down and
wanting to keep it under 125, exactly.
At what time in your career did you feel like you really found your voice? Because it wasn't from the start, right? I mean, you were opinionated, but it wasn't like, oh, this is exactly it.
Yeah, although my first collection, which I'm going to repeat at 40 years, still stands up, you know. I mean, my first collection is the one where I took interlinings and I made them look like beautiful linens and I bleached fabrics. I sort of made clothes that like looked like versions of things, but they weren't necessarily the thing themselves. And those were very successful. Those were the clothes I'm to this day most probably most connected to. But
yeah.
I think when I started doing the wrap dresses, I think that in terms of what I do, the sensuality of what I do, like what my clothes are about, you know, I think, James Baldwin said, you can't have a conversation without revealing something about yourself. And I think my clothes a little bit, you know, they expose you a little bit.
I think so too. Yeah.
They're not clothes that cover you up.
You can't hide behind them. Yeah.
You can't hide them. So you know, so
they reveal you. I think they reveal you.
They
yeah.
do reveal you. And that's a slightly uncomfortable position to be in, but it's also the kind of energy that is motivating.
I always said, like, for my clients too, yeah. I always felt like the clothes that I chose or the what I believed in for my clients was,
yes.
you know, that people will notice you.
Yes.
And you better be ready.
Yes.
Not everybody connects to that. You know, a lot of people do want to hide behind their clothes. And I don't think that we sell that. That's not what I'm drawn to. I think it's about making you the most beautiful person and the most confident person in the room. And again, like, you better be ready for that because people are going to talk to you.
Absolutely. Exactly. And Cole Booker, who just won the 1500, you don't have to start in the front. You can come from behind.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You don't have to be the one who attracted the most attention when you arrived. You know, there are other circumstances. To that point, I think the worst plight for any artist is to be more interesting than their work. I mean, it's far worse than being have a writer's block or repeating yourself. But like if you can't get your work to speak for itself, it's the worst plight. I mean, because I've known brilliant people who are in that situation, and it's
I have too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel it pertains a little bit to clothes as well. If your clothes are the most interesting thing about you, after a while, you know, I'm going to get a little bored. So
yeah,
you know,
I totally I mean, agree. So, it's a great point. It's a great point.
So clothes kind of, you know, by well-dressed person, there's got to be a little bit of mystery. There's got to be a little bit of a question, a little bit of a doubt, a little bit of a this or that. And I mean, rather than it all spelled out, you know, when I see, I mean, listen, I love fashion and I love all the spectacle of it and all the things people bring to it. But it's also restrictive. It isolates you. It can sequester you in a way that I'm not comfortable in. I am too malleable. I want to fit into as many situations as possible because and I think my clothes are a little socially mobile because they are clothes that
They
fix you.
definitely are.
I think my customer travels a broader life. They're not going to fashion shows, or that's the only context that they want to be seen in. They've got real lives.
What's the most challenging moment in the last 30 years of your business?
We've been blessed with extraordinary loyal clientele on the store level and on a consumer level. The people, there's no obligation. If I buy Gucci this season, I'm under no obligation to buy it next season as a consumer. There's no I have a customer who's bought the clothes for 20 years, for 30
Every single
years,
season.
every single season, and
It's so
it's
true.
daunting. It's and I'm humbled and and I don't know, I feel very flattered by that.
That must be how you continue to reinvent it because you don't want to let them down.
I didn't know, true. And to let them down is to give them the same stuff over and over again. And I feel most people's aesthetics, they're not fixed, but the woman who buys from me in spring, when she comes in fall, she kind of lives in the same house. She's married to the same husband. She's got the same kids. She's not going to want to go from being goth to cowgirl. It's like she's a little more even keeled. And listen, people with great style develop a certain style that they maintain. And I think we all kind of seek to do that.
I definitely have not had anybody from Zimbabwe, so I don't think you had proms in Zimbabwe. Did you have one
I
in Cape
did.
Town?
I did. I
Really?
did.
Oh,
Yes, yes,
and
yeah,
what did
yes.
you wear?
Oh my God. I think I wore a regular suit, but my date, was my statement, I think. I took I took a girl named Monique Wengrove, and she wore no shoes, and she had I don't know what she'd done, and she introduced herself to the headmaster as her name was Moon, and that was my choice of prom night, and it was a.
Do you remember? Do you remember what she wore?
She wore she looked good, but
But no
she
shoes.
no shoes. She took the shoes off. She was a wild child.
I would love to know what Moon's doing now. Thank you, Peter, so much.
Really, thank you so much.
Thank
Really
you.
appreciate this.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.